telling the backstory to a shocking murder in 18th century Alabama.
I found this bizarre nugget of history. There's not a lot of information about it, but a white man and a black man and an Indian man did indeed encounter each other in this region in 1788 and did become sort of highway robbers and attacked a trading party coming down from the Creek Nation, and then were followed by a Frenchman who was sent to track them down. When I found that, I looked for their backstories and for any other information I could find about these three men, and there wasn't anything. And so the great joy for me was imagining myself into their backstory, because the backstories really do explain how three such different people could coexist in this period in which you think there's no way a white man and a black man and an Indian man would have anything in common. And in fact, they do.
That's Katie Simpson-Smith. We talk with her about her new novel, Free Men. Then, in the second half of the show, we replay our 2014 interview with Smith about her acclaimed first novel, Story of Land and Sea. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Liberty has always been the animating myth of the American idea. Strange, because so much of what our country is was built by denying liberty to slaves, to the propertyless, to the native peoples we subjugated. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was originally pretty much for white propertied men, men of power. Katie Simpson-Smith's new novel, Free Men, examines what happens when three men who society sees as powerless decide to set their own course for liberty. Set in 1788 in the territory that would one day become Alabama, it brings together these unlikely companions, an escaped slave, a white orphan, and a Creek Indian of noble birth who's been denied his proper tribal station. Based on a real event, the plot concerns what happens when the three commit a shocking murder. The authorities hire a French tracker to bring the killers to justice, a man whose mission vies with his desire to understand his quarry and the new America to which they belong. Free Men traces the complex motives that lead to the trio's association with each other and the crime they commit. It also follows the women they leave behind, posing competing loyalties between the pull of family and the fierce desire for a better life. Katie Simpson-Smith was born and raised in Jackson, Mississippi. She attended Mount Holyoke College and received a Ph.D. in history from the University of North Carolina. She's the author of We Have Raised All of You, Motherhood in the South, 1750 to 1835, and the novels The Story of Land and Sea and Free Men. Well, Katie Simpson-Smith, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's good to be back again.
Now, this book, Free Men, this is your second historical novel about the post-Revolutionary War period. We spoke to you about the first one, Story of Land and Sea. And this, when we're talking about post-Revolutionary War, we're talking about just after the Revolutionary War. What is so attractive to you about this period?
That's an excellent question. I do keep returning to it, both in fiction and nonfiction, because it's what I worked on for my dissertation in graduate school. I think what's so captivating about this period in American history is the amount of uncertainty that still existed. You see later in the 19th century and certainly the 20th century, you have a kind of American society that's become solidified in terms of classes and races and what position people are expected to fill. But at this period, there's a lot of everything's up in the air in terms of what the young country will look like in terms of justice and democracy. Whether slavery is still on the table as a possible blight or a source of income for the country, and they're still figuring that stuff out. So I love looking at characters and seeing how they see their individual lives fitting into this larger system of the Republic at this time.
Well, it surprises me that you say that, because I would almost think that the 19th century, when you had the growth of the abolition movement, and then you had the Civil War, and then you had the Industrial Revolution, that's what would have, you know, broken everything wide open. And I don't think most of us think of this period, the colonial or just post-colonial period, as being one where everything is in flux. Could you say more about that?
Sure. So one of the things that's so interesting about those 19th century progressive movements is that they were trying to break down these systems that had come in place so quickly after the revolution. And you see this happening in other countries as well, who undergo a pretty radical revolution and then find themselves once again replicating the social structures that they had attempted to knock down. I mean, the same thing happens in America. So you have people coming from all kinds of places, from fleeing religious persecution in England and in other parts of Europe, slaves coming from Africa, some of whom remain enslaved and some of whom become free people of color, and Native Americans who have a very complex system of sort of states warring against each other long before other people arrived. And so seeing them all jostling for control, especially in this geographical region that I'm looking at in the South, it's very different from the North at this period in terms of being much more politically contested.
More politically contested. What were the contestants here?
So the Freeman is set in South Alabama, or what is now known as Alabama, and back then the action mostly takes place in 1788. And it's this very bizarre sort of area in the Deep South that is between French lands to the west, British and then American lands to the east, and Spanish lands to the south, and Creek Indian lands to the north. And all of these nations claim this territory. And so when you're actually walking through this territory in the late 18th century, it's very dangerous. You don't know whose land you're on or who could come and snatch you at any moment. And so doing the research for this project was fascinating, to see sort of how these different groups tried to make claim over this piece of southern land.
And so here we have three protagonists, and I guess you could call another antagonist. You've got the three men. There's Cat, who is a white man. Bob is a runaway slave. And Istalicha, is that how you'd pronounce his name? Istalicha, who is a Creek Indian. So ground us with these characters, because they really, I mean, this is very much a kind of, a first person, a tale told in the first person voices of each one of these characters. So we're really seeing things from their point of view. Let's start with Bob, because I think you start the book with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Bob grew up on a plantation in Virginia and then was sold down to a plantation in Pensacola after a series of sort of tragic accidents that happened to his family, including the death of his brother and the sale of his mother. So he's sort of seeing firsthand how the system of slavery is, sort of dehumanizing those around him. But he has this sort of streak of optimism that's almost impossible to totally destroy. And so he keeps trying to imagine a life for himself that's separate from the life that has been assigned to him by the white people around him. And so he gets it into his head that somewhere out west, far past where all the white people have gotten to, there could be a patch of land that he could claim as his own. And so he dreams about one day getting a farm for himself out there. And so he does end up running away, and ends up encountering this white man and then this Indian man in the woods in South Alabama, and has to figure out how to hold on to that dream while interacting with these very different people.
Yeah, I mean, Cat is such an interesting person, very almost deranged, one would say. I mean, was reading his first-person tale took a certain amount of deconstruction of his story, because he's somebody who comes from a very abused background. Talk about him and talk about finding his voice in creating the story.
Yeah, his voice is the one that I feel the closest to. I have so much love for poor Cat. He grew up without a mother. His father was an alcoholic and was very abusive, and ends up dying when Cat is still fairly young. So he's sent to a Catholic orphanage and is suddenly around a lot of other people after being around just one man for, you know, 7 or 8 years. And so he's very disoriented, and he doesn't really have either the emotional skills or the linguistic skills to compute what's happening to him. So he sees the world sort of through a child's eyes. He has a very primitive outlook on what's going on around him. But he manages to escape from the orphanage after a small tragedy, and then ends up falling in love with this woman in South Carolina, and that love is sort of what seems like will redeem him. But then he finds himself once more sort of on the run from his own past. And so by the time he gets down to Alabama and meets Bob and Isalicia, he's sort of at the end of his psychological rope, which is a very interesting place to write from for me as a writer, trying to get into that headspace of when you've basically lost everything and are still sort of putting one foot in front of the other. And so I loved sort of seeing how he reimagined his life such that it could still have this possibility of hope for him.
How did you do that?
I think one way to do it, this is sort of like method acting, but imagining the bad things that have happened to me in my life, which are minuscule compared to what have happened to these people, and then figuring out how to amplify that, to take the emotion that I feel after a given event and then say, what would it be like if this were tenfold worse? And then, I don't know, I think writers love to imagine the worst just as a way to see what the limits of the human soul are.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Katie Simpson Smith about her new novel, Free Men. It takes place in the late 18th century American South and follows a story of three men, an escaped slave, a white orphan, and a Native American, who strike out to better their lives and end up committing a terrible crime. You know, one thing that it seems that Kat and Bob both have in common is that they are almost blasé about the physical abuse to which they're subjected. I mean, it just is something they just expect as part of life.
Right, yeah.
Then there's Isalicia, who of the trio is probably the most highborn by far. Mm-hmm. Tell us about him.
Sure. So he was born to a family with a lot of power in the Creek Nation. His uncle, who is his closest male relative in the Creek lineage system, is actually the chief of his town. So he grows up with the expectation that either he or his brothers will one day take over the chiefdom. But he witnesses his uncle's murder when he is on a hunting party with various other men from the tribe. And that sets off a chain of events in which he sort of hounds his uncle's murderer subtly for many years, trying to figure out how best to seek revenge for that murder and how to reclaim the town from this very evil man who has taken over. And so he has a much more political outlook on life than either Bob or Kat do. I think because he's had the freedom of, you know, not having as much suffering as the others, you know, he has sort of leisure time to imagine how best to construct his life personally and the life of the town that he's living in. So, and he falls in love as well with a very complicated woman who ends up betraying him, which sets him on the road down to South Alabama, where he will encounter the others.
Right. Now, I read somewhere that this story is based on something that really happened. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. So I found this bizarre nugget of history. There's not a lot of information about it, but a white man and a black man and an Indian man did indeed encounter each other in this region in 1788 and did become sort of highway robbers and attacked a trading party coming down from the Creek Nation, and then were followed by a Frenchman who was sent to track them down. When I found that, I looked for their backstories and for any other information I could find about these three men, and there wasn't anything. And so the great joy for me was imagining myself into their backstory, because the backstories really do explain how three such different people could coexist in this period in which you think there's no way a white man and a black man and an Indian man would have anything in common. And in fact, they do.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Katie Simpson Smith about her second novel, like her first, set in the South in the just post-war, post-Revolutionary War period. It's called Free Men. So when I talk to authors about their novels, there are all kinds of things that we really can't talk about because we don't want to have spoilers. But
right.
As you mentioned, there is a crime that's committed here. And, you know, it was so curious because it seemed like these three protagonists are just not people who would be capable of such a crime.
Yeah. And it sort of highlights, too, how it's actually like we're all capable of violent action when we're pushed to certain limits. And, you know, it's so easy to vilify, especially in modern society, people who do violent things. And you think, oh, well, I would never do something like that. And I can't imagine how you could, you know, pull a gun on another person. And so figuring out how to make characters who are sympathetic, but who also reach this point beyond which violence seems like the only answer to them, that was a very interesting challenge to write about.
And, for example, Bob, you know, kind of feels, I mean, they justify it to themselves. Mm-hmm. And certainly Bob does. I'm not so sure that that's so true for a cat.
Right.
Do you want to say something about,
It was tricky finding the balance between having them justify it so that it makes sense for their characters, but also making sure that they feel conflicted and guilty, which I think Bob increasingly does. You know, in the moment, he thinks this is absolutely right, and, you know, I will do anything to guarantee my freedom. And then after the sort of the robbery and the murders, he slowly acquires this guilt that kind of haunts him. Mm-hmm. And it's too late to really fix it, but he imagines that he could, the best way to put things right is to live the rest of his life to the fullest.
Such a quintessentially American solution.
Right. Yeah. And the balance, too, between self-interest and, you know, each man standing on his own and fighting for his own individual needs, which is very American, but also the sense that we're all in it together and this melting pot can actually be beneficial. That's American, too. And so figuring out where that balance is was also interesting to write about.
Yeah, if you could talk more about that. I mean, the whole theme of freedom in the novel, you know, which is, you know, land of the free, home of the brave. And mm-hmm. It's right there in the title, Free Men. Could you talk about that theme and the contradictory eddies and currents of it in this book?
Yeah. So I think you really get a sense of that through the perspective of the Frenchman who's tracking them down. He's a man named Leclerc who came over from France because he was sort of at loose ends and was looking for adventure and was excited by the idea of the revolutionary happenings over in America. So he comes over and ends up falling in with a group of Creek Indians and becoming an advisor to them and a tracker. He's very interested in sort of what makes humans tick. So as he's following these three men who are on the run, he's trying to figure out what this whole American project is all about. Because to his mind, these men, the first thing they should do after committing a crime is to separate. Split the money, separate, go their own way, figure out how to live their lives separately. And the fact that they don't, that they stick together, is very confusing to him. And it goes against this idea of freedom, of American freedom being the ability to be an individual and to not take part in class systems of old Europe. But what the three men see as freedom, I think, is so much more complicated and nuanced because Bob has literally taken his own freedom by escaping from the slave plantation. And yet, here he is sort of enmeshed with these other men and he doesn't want to extricate himself from that. And so freedom isn't just about being on your own. He also left a wife behind that he ends up regretting and wishing that he had taken her with him. That freedom actually exists in this matrix with everyone else around you, and figuring out how to honor that and how to take the gifts that other people can give you while still resisting any kind of system that's built on oppression or hierarchy or privilege. It's just a very tricky balance for these three men, and I think they're still trying to figure it out by the end of the book.
We're talking with Katie Simpson Smith about her new novel, Free Men. And I want to get back to that wife, but before I do, there's something that Leclerc says, the antagonist, the guy who's tracking them down. He says that he wanted to prove that there was a sublayer to humanity common across the classes. And, you know, I thought about that. I thought, is that an idea that would have been extant in his time?
Yeah, so in the late 18th century, we have this sort of blossoming of scientific inquiry. And so a lot of people are trying to categorize plants and animals and meteorological systems and basically anything that they can observe, they want to put into categories. And so this starts happening with people, too, sort of the birth of anthropology as we know it today. And I think Leclerc is on the sort of the cutting edge of that and trying to figure out what binds humans as a species, because he's seen, you know, very different behavior in France than he sees in America. And yet there is the same, you know, division of the classes. There's still the rich and the poor. And so trying to figure out what makes a human is something that's very compelling for him. And he keeps guessing at what that common sublayer might be, but still not understanding sort of the mystical qualities of people that draw them together that can't fully be explained in a scientific way, I think.
Yeah, but there's also the common bonds of love and family, which you also explore in this book, and mm-hmm. you explore how the characters are confronting love and family, each one of them. Talk a little bit about Bob and Winna, and then a little bit more about, you know, Winna is Bob's wife who decides not to go with him. I mean, he may regret right. not bringing her, but she had no intention of going.
Yeah, so Winna is the wife that he was basically assigned by the owner of the plantation. So he had sort of emotional feelings of love for another woman, but was married off to this virtual stranger. So they try to figure out what a marriage like that looks like. And I think they get to this point of certainly mutual affection. And I think Bob especially is reluctant to call it love because he's seen that the people that he's really loved in his life have all been taken away from him and that love is just a form of vulnerability. And Winna is a very strong-willed woman who is certainly not going to do anything that Bob tells her to do just because he tells her. And she is determined to stay behind because they have children together. And she knows that if an entire family, especially one with young children, attempts to escape, that the odds of their being captured are so much higher. And she's not willing to risk the lives of her children, which Bob is willing to risk. So they have different ideas about sort of the value of family and whether a family can survive in slavery, which Winna argues they can. And Bob argues that a family in slavery is not really a family worth saving. So he ends up leaving, and then we get a little bit of Winna's perspective after she's been left behind and what life on the plantation looks like from the perspective of a woman without sort of that male protector, which can be a little bit grim.
Yeah, and this is something that I assume would draw on your PhD dissertation. Is that right? Kind of the life
yes.
of Winna? Yeah, talk a little bit about how your scholarly work informed this character.
Right. So I did most of my research in my past life as a historian was about women in the early American South, and particularly mothers. So I looked at sort of cross-cultural comparisons of motherhood of white women and black women and Native American women. And one of the most fascinating areas of research for me was figuring out what it meant to be a wife and a mother for an enslaved woman at this time period, because there are so few sources left behind. We don't have first-person accounts written by enslaved women because most of them were not allowed to learn to read or write. So there's a lot of sort of reading between the lines in plantation accounts that were written by white men or slave narratives that were written by black men for the abolition movement in the 19th century. So you get sort of sidelong glances at women's lives. And as a researcher, I always had to restrict myself to speculative language. Like, we can imagine that a woman's life might have looked like such and such based on these hints. But as a fiction writer, I get to totally dive in and imagine all of her emotions and the range of her experience, which I think is so valuable to have in fiction, because if we don't speculate and imagine, then those lives end up being a very small part of the history that we study instead of being a major part of the history in the way that they deserve.
Isn't that scary, though? Aren't you afraid of, striking a note that is not, congruent with the time?
Oh, absolutely. It's terrifying. But I feel that same sort of terror when I write about anyone in the past, because one doesn't really know. We don't have these people to sit down across from and ask all of the questions that we want to ask them. And I think it just speaks to the imaginative project of fiction in general. The fiction that I'm interested in writing and in reading is the kind of fiction that explores things way outside of our personal experience. Like, I'm not interested in writing about, the life of a young white woman growing up in the 21st century South. I want to learn about people and places and eras that are very different from my own. And so that's what I love about writing. But I as you say, it comes with a lot of responsibility, too. And I think the best that one can do is research and learn as much as possible about the lives of these people and try to be faithful to what that research reveals.
In a way, you could say you're like Leclerc, who are
yeah.
proving this. Yeah. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I am the Leclerc to Leclerc and the others.
Right. And finding that common, what makes us, our humanity common, not just across the classes, but across the eras.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. If I can make 21st century readers find something familiar in an 18th century life, I think I will have done my job.
Well, it's a terrific book, and I wish you much success with it. It's Free Men, and we've been talking with the author, Katie Simpson Smith. Thank you so much for talking with us about this book.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Katie Simpson Smith. Free Men is out from HarperCollins. Read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we re-air our 2014 interview with Smith about her first novel, Story of Land and Sea. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the first half of today's show, we talked with Katie Simpson Smith about her new novel, Free Men. Now, let's listen to my 2014 interview with her about her acclaimed first novel, Story of Land and Sea. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Before publishing her acclaimed debut novel, The Story of Land and Sea, Katie Simpson Smith was a historian. Her previous book was a study of motherhood in the American South from 1750 to 1835. The research for that book enabled her to get into the minds of the men and women who lived during that period, a time of great transition in America from subjugated colony to independent nation. The South and parts of the North were still in the grip of the slave system, of course, but even there the winds of liberty began to blow. In The Story of Land and Sea, Smith explores this transitional time through the lives of her vividly drawn characters. Set in a small coastal town in North Carolina during the waning years of the American Revolution, the novel follows three generations of family, fathers and daughters, mother and son, master and slave. The Story of Land and Sea is published by HarperCollins. Katie Simpson-Smith, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This novel, The Story of Land and Sea, takes place during the American Revolution. Tell us about the time that it's set in and the place.
So this novel is set at the very tail end of the Revolution, which is a very interesting time to me to put characters in, because it's sort of asking them to imagine a world that has not yet fully formed. America as a country is still very young and figuring itself out. And I think that reflects in the characters as well in terms of how they maneuver themselves through that very uncertain world. And the book is set in coastal North Carolina, which has a similar uncertainty to it. It's on the coast, but it's not easily accessed by ships because of the rocky coastline. And so you have these characters that are living their lives both on land and in sea, and in this sort of marshy territory in between.
And it's a kind of precarious life in some ways. Is that right?
It is, absolutely. Death is always on the horizon for people during this time period, and it certainly rears its head in this book as well.
It's a book that has some real tragedies at the center of it, and it concerns three intertwined families who share those tragedies. It begins with a father telling stories to his daughter about her mother. Tell us what's happening.
So the mother has died during childbirth, which means the daughter, Tabitha, never got a chance to know her. And as a result, she sort of builds the mother up into this figure that she wants to know better. So she's always pestering her father to hear stories about her. And the father, understandably, has difficulty sharing that part of his life with his daughter because his loss is still very raw. And when the daughter becomes sick, he has to decide what he will do to try to save her life and whether his actions will replicate some of the actions in his past.
What do you mean by replicate those actions in his past?
So when he first married the girl's mother, he took her to sea on a ship for about a year. And they had a wonderful time. It was sort of this blossoming of their romance at sea. And so he ends up taking his daughter to sea in an attempt to save her life, thinking that the ocean is the place where good things happen.
So one of the tragedies is that Tabitha, who's the young girl, her mother, Helen, died in childbirth, as you said, and then she also perishes from yellow fever. Talk a little bit about her father, how he responds to this, and then also about his father-in-law, Asa, because there's kind of a twin story of bereavement here and bereavement through the generations. And I wonder if you could trace that out for us.
One of the interesting things about these two characters is that they have both lost daughters that were extremely beloved. But because they're from two different generations, they react to those deaths in very different ways. Asa, the older of the two, finds comfort in religion and believes that if he just follows the rule of the Bible every day, that somehow God will forgive him and stop punishing him with the death of his loved ones. John, on the other hand, sort of fights against religion and sees God as a punisher and someone who takes away willfully people that he loves. So the two men's relationship with God is, I think, inherent to the story of their loss.
And we should say here that this is your first novel, but it's not your first book. You've written a historical book about motherhood during this very time, and we'll get back to that theme of motherhood later. But I just want to tell our listeners that you're a historian. And so I want to ask you here, is that shift in the way these two men deal with their bereavement, is that something that is true to the changing consciousness in America at that time? And if so, what was that change and how did that come about?
one of the interesting things about this time period is that there is a shift towards a more individualistic practice of religion. So you have the Great Awakening earlier in the 18th century that is very tuned into these ideas that are prevalent in America of, you know, every man for himself and an individual personal relationship with God. And I think that's what you're seeing with John more so than Asa, the sense that God is not just an all-powerful being, but someone that you can actually talk to and reason with, even though he may not listen. And so there's so many changes, social and cultural and economic, during this period of the 1780s and 1790s. It's been fun to sort of put my characters in those difficult positions and see how they react.
Could you talk a little bit more about how, as a historian and a new fiction writer, you approached weaving these two stances together?
It's been very interesting moving from the role of historian to the role of novelist, because I've had to let go of a lot of my feelings about needing citations for everything and having to document everything. And as a result, it's been very freeing. I've been allowed to sort of go into the emotional minds of these characters and get into not only, you know, their day-to-day actions, but the motivations behind those actions. And, you know, while I can say that most of them are grounded in historical truth and that these actions may have been possible during this period, there's also the sense that, you know, I've made stuff up, and a lot of the characters' feelings about their loved ones, about loss, about love itself, one can never really know from just studying the historical record alone.
In your work as a historian, you must have read a lot of course, primary sources. Do you feel that you brought a 21st century consciousness to your characters, or did you really imbibe the 18th century consciousness in order to create the dialogue, in order to create the whole personalities that you were exploring in this book?
That's a great question. I tried to completely erase my 21st century consciousness. As you noted, I had to read, you know, hundreds of letters and diaries and plantation records for my dissertation. And having been steeped in that language of that time period, it really sort of, the rhythms of it got into my head. And so I felt as I was writing that I was doing them justice in terms of not only how they would have sounded, but how they might have felt. And part of erasing my 21st century mind is getting into the head of Asa, the grandfather here, who is a slave owner and who believes that slave owning is morally defensible. And, of course, as a 21st century person, we would say that that would be hard to understand. And so trying to understand him and trying to create that figure to be sympathetic was one of my main challenges, but I felt that was the only way to do the time period justice.
And I just thought it was really marvelous the way you explore these, the theme of slavery. You have a very key character in this book, and I mentioned before three intertwined families. You know, we have Asa and his daughter, and then, of course, the family of his son-in-law and his daughter, Tabitha. And then you have the family of Mal and her husband, although when we first meet her, she's not married yet. Tell us about Mal. This is a time in the book where you actually go back in time to when Helen, Asa's daughter, is a young woman. And we explore this relationship between her and her slave, Mal. Talk about that relationship.
Yeah, so Helen is given Mal as a birthday gift for her 10th birthday. And that relationship alone is so defined by this idea of ownership and this idea that someone can be given to someone else. So as they grow older, they're the only two young women on the plantation, and they necessarily become quite close, are very sister-like in some ways, and yet the power dynamic always rears its head and never fully allows them to love and understand each other as one might hope. And so when Mal is a little bit older, she is given in marriage to another slave on a neighboring plantation, and she has no choice in the matter. And for Helen, this doesn't seem out of the ordinary because she's African-American. She's not white, and so Helen doesn't understand why such a person would even consider choice in marriage. So it's another one of those instances where these characters that we've grown to love have a reaction that is completely antithetical to everything that we think is good and proper. And so the two of them jostling for control in the relationship is sort of an interesting dynamic.
And Katie Simpson-Smith, in this wonderful novel, The Story of Land and Sea, in exploring this relationship between the two of them, you have a situation you've just described where Mal is forced into a marriage and Helen bucks tradition in order to marry for love. Could you just delve a little bit deeper into the tension between those two different circumstances, those two different choices?
Yes. It speaks to the time period that women of all races had fairly little control over their own marriages. And we see one extreme in Mal, who is, as you say, forced to marry against her will. And then on the other hand, we have Helen, who her father tries to set up marriages for her with the eligible bachelors in town. But against all odds, she falls in love with a stranger and goes against her father's wishes and goes against her sort of familial duty in helping out with the plantation to run away with this man in a time when that was seen as very shocking. And so both of their marriages also reflect on Asa, Helen's father, who is trying to dictate all of this and is having increasing trouble managing the women in his life.
And yet, as you said before, he's a sympathetic character, and I love the way he wrestles with the conflict between the dictates of society and the dictates of love.
I think he is the character that most sort of embodies the tension in this time period. So much of America is found in tradition because of its tie to England, and yet it's trying to break free from that and create an identity that's very separate and that's very independent and very individualistic. And Asa is sort of sitting right in the middle of this and watching his daughter rebel against the system. And I think, you know, there are mirrors of him in all eras of society. These people that come from a conservative background and are faced with sort of increasingly liberal social beliefs. And he really does try his best to do what's right for his family and his daughter. But it's hard for him to reconcile that with what he thinks is morally and religiously his duty.
And I think this struggle comes very much to a head at the end of the book where Mal asks him to free her. Tell us about his initial reaction, and then as much as you feel free to do so without giving something away you don't want to give away, some of the evolution and thought that he goes through after that.
So when Mal asks for her freedom as a result of a chain of events that make her life increasingly unlivable, he rejects it on the premise that she should earn her freedom, that there's this belief in, you know, the self-made man. And if she wants her freedom, then he will allow her opportunities to earn money for herself. And eventually, after years and years of collecting, you know, nickels and dimes, she will eventually be able to earn her own freedom. And from Mal's perspective, this seems outrageous, that no man or woman should have to earn her freedom. It should be a God-given right. And after their encounter, and Asa continues to think about what the difference is between theory and principle and an actual individual plea, I think he starts revising some of those ideas and comes to realize that Mal is not just a slave, but is a person who has been related to him and his family for the past 20 years or so.
We're speaking with author Katie Simpson-Smith about her debut novel, The Story of Land and Sea. She's also the author of a previous book, but this one, a historical book, We Have Raised All of You, Motherhood in the South, 1750 to 1835. I want to ask you about that other book because you get into the minds of each of these characters. So there's no one point of view. The point of view shifts between all of them. And in Mal's character, you take the opportunity to really explore the issue of motherhood and slavery. And I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that. What were the sources that you drew from for this picture? And tell us a little bit about the motherhood in the South during this period.
One of the things that jumped out at me most when working on the dissertation, as it became the history book, is that motherhood was never sort of a uniform proposition across the South, that women experienced it as they do today in so many different ways, and that it meant such different things to women depending on where they lived or their age or their religion or their, you know, state of freedom. And for Mal, who has these children with a man that she doesn't really love, and who sees that those children will be brought up in the same state of bondage that she is, motherhood means something very different than a sort of privileged white woman who has these children because she sees them as, or that she's trying to raise them to take on the family plantation one day. So for Mal, she has very conflicted feelings towards some of her children. Her first child is a son, and she sort of pours all of her maternal love into him because she can't help herself. And when she has children after him, is when she starts realizing that they will become part of a system that has been so cruel to her. And it's painful to have to watch your children suffer in any way, you know, much less be enslaved. And so the reactions she has towards motherhood, I think, are a lot more complex than one might assume based on popular ideas about instinctive nurturing or instinctive love in a mother, which I found is really just not true at all.
Could you say more about that?
So we have this idea that when a woman has a child, there is this sort of natural love that comes from her towards her child. And if we look at motherhood historically, there's such a wide range of responses from mothers towards their children. Sometimes they're sources of love and joy. Other times they're economic burdens, or they come out of very terrible situations, either through rape or through slavery, and they become these symbols of have a life that the mother would rather the child not have. And so for me, being able to write a character that has these complex emotions was a wonderful opportunity to show one aspect of that range of experiences of motherhood in this time period.
And yet Mal is not a typical slave, woman slave in the South of this time. She speaks in an educated manner. She's literate. Why did you choose to explore slavery through this character who in herself embodied real contradictions, even of class and station within herself? Why did you choose to develop a character that embodied these kinds of contradictions?
For me, one of the most interesting things about fiction is going into the minds of people that you don't know much about or that you haven't heard much about. And so being able to explore this time period in this place allowed me to look at people whose lives are not always in the historical record. So Mal is not your typical slave in that she's on a very small plantation with very few slaves around her. And she is treated fairly well. You know, she's clothed and fed and taught to read and write, which is extremely rare for that time period. And yet I wanted to show how even under these quote-unquote ideal conditions of slavery, it can be so galling to the soul to be trapped in that way. And so when she attempts to break free of it, it shows sort of one facet of all the slaves that were yearning to break free during that time period.
Now, the novel, The Story of Land and Sea, ends in a very indeterminate manner. We won't reveal how it ends, but I know I really wanted to know what happened next. Why did you leave the reader hanging like that?
That's a good question. For me, the book sort of came to a natural end there, and I like the way that it allows readers to imagine various alternative endings for themselves. It sort of puts the reader in the position of author and says, okay, I've left you with these characters in this situation. What do you want to happen next?
I guess that's a good answer, and that gives me permission to decide exactly how I do want it to end. Now, this novel was acquired in a 10-house, 7-bidder auction. How did you manage to, fall? Was it incredible luck or something else that put you in that position as a debut novelist?
It was definitely luck. I had a wonderful, wonderful agent who believed very strongly in me and my book. And he sort of sold it with a passion that I am eternally grateful for. But I know that this happens very rarely to debut authors. And so I'm just so grateful to be published at all and to have attention being directed towards the book. Just makes me feel so happy and excited for my characters.
That's great. Well, I'm happy and excited for you because this is a wonderful novel, The Story of Land and Sea. Katie Simpson-Smith, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice, and I look forward to more fiction from you. Are you planning another book?
I am. I'm working on my second novel right now.
And is it also a historical novel?
It is also historical and set in the South.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to talking with you about that when it comes out.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, same here. Thanks so much. That was Katie Simpson-Smith, and as we promised back in 2014 when we talked with her about The Story of Land and Sea, we did catch up with her about her new book, Free Men, in the first half of today's show. Next up, a review of Irish writer Mary Costello's debut novel, Academy Street. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. It's perhaps a banal observation that we live our lives on the inside far differently than the selves we project to others. Mary Costello's debut novel, Academy Street, illumines this internal self in her spare and moving portrait of the novel's protagonist, Tess. Academy Street follows Tess from her early childhood in Western Ireland through her relocation to New York as a nurse, single mother, and retiree, ending finally with a family reunion at her elder brother's funeral back in Ireland. The novel opens with a signal event, the loss of Tess's mother at the age of 7. The shock renders her mute for several years, but even after she recovers her speech, she cannot shake the sense of standing apart from others. It's as if she has lost the power to communicate her inner self. Throughout her life, she carries forward a kind of social muteness. Tess's relationships are few. She has but one close friend, a neighbor woman whose warmth and practicality ground her. A brief passionate affair ends before Tess realizes she's pregnant, and eventually her son, who she raises as a single parent, grows distant. Tess is, for the most part, alone. Yet her inner life is rich, filled with tender observations of the minute details of existence, the flight of a bird, a visit to a museum. Undistracted by relationships, she's free to train her attention inward to examine her own feelings and her reactions to the external world. As Tess grows older and then old, a deep sense of connection to life as it is lived blossoms despite, or perhaps even because, of the repeated losses she experiences. Over the 7 decades the novel covers, a portrait emerges of a woman who trods a solitary path, beginning in fear and confusion, but ending with a measure of peace and wisdom. The novel is slim but deep in scope. Mary Costello's first book was a story collection, The China Factory, published in 2012. Academy Street is published by Picador. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. While we have some time left, let's listen to 2 poems by Western Massachusetts poet Amy Dryansky. Here's the title poem from her 2014 poetry volume, Grass Whistle.
Grass Whistle. What I wanted was a rose, an open mouth. What I got was this slender blade of grass. It can sing or cut. Stretch it taut between your thumbs and send your breath there. A little breath and a little time. What comes out the other side? Who slips out the back door? What did you hide beneath your mattress you wanted nobody to see? Hold it to the light. Is it smaller than you remember? Does it still sting? Climb down from your treehouse and feel how the cool earth yields to your bare feet. That's a kind of welcome. Remember this when you're falling, or falling asleep, take the dream you're given, pull the covers up tight. Who are you tonight? This morning, I'm the one who got away. Last night, the one who couldn't run fast enough. Most of the time, I'm the one who has to choose. I can't. My closets are bursting, the attics full of what I love, broken or breaking. Tonight, I'll dream of what to let go. To get ready, I'll unpack, put the books back on their shelves, comb dead leaves from my hair, memorize some commandments. I can't lay down my sword and shield, but if I stand very still, I might hear the wind move around me.
Amy Dryansky reading her poem, Grass Whistle. And now she reads another poem, Point of Origin.
Point of Origin. I don't remember much. A feeling of pressure. Then someone took the cover off. But it wasn't happily ever after. More like the ocean, flat and smooth, until you can't stand it. Then, regrets. I get sick a lot. I was born in Cleveland. I stuck a hairpin in an outlet. So many ways to be disqualified. My daughter rolls her eyes, and I wonder where she went. Hope she'll come back. This, after working furiously not to be needed. Even so, I'm starting to like the way life tosses you around, though it goes against my true nature. My true nature is to sit in the shade, watch the birds at their business, and envy them, but not enough to think I can fly. Not enough to fly. Once there was a girl who lost her way home. She knocked on no one's door. My true nature is to feel uncomfortable, worry I've said too much, but I won't take it back. That's why I'm still standing here, half in the light.
Amy Dryansky reading her poem, Point of Origin. To hear our 2014 interview with her about her poetry volume, Grass Whistle, go to writersvoice.net. And coming up next week, a biography and a novel. We talk with Cecilia Tichy about her biography, Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. And Ellen Mirapol tells us about her new novel, On Hurricane Island. It's about what happens when an ordinary woman, a mathematician with no ties to terrorism, is rendered to a U.S. black site in Maine. That's all coming up next week on Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.